Can you see my title slide?
Yes.
Okay, great. I believe that our applicant is here today and we are ready to start the meeting. So I'd like to welcome everyone to this meeting of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission Engineering Criteria Review Board.
Okay, and so I believe that's my cue. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the BCDC Virtual Engineering Criteria Review Board meeting. My name is Rod Iwashta, and I'm chair of BCDC's Engineering Criteria Review Board, or ECRB. Our first order of business is to call the roll. Board members, please unmute yourselves and respond, then mute yourselves again after responding. Jen, can you please call roll?
I will. Chair Iwashita?
Here.
Vice Chair Jim French?
Here.
Board members Bob Battaglia?
Here.
Bill Holmes? Bill is not here. Chris May?
Here.
Jima Casali?
Here.
Ramin Golosorki?
Here.
Nick Sitar? I know Nick's not here today. Gail Johnson? I know Gail is also not here today. Talia Travasaru?
Here.
Dilip Trivedi?
Here.
Justin Vandiver?
Here.
Is there anyone whose name I have not called? Great, thanks. We do have a quorum present. So Rod, you may continue business.
All right. Okay, and it looks like somebody is going to show how to raise virtual hands for public comments, or maybe we hold that until just before public comment. So let's go through the meeting procedure review. Just want to make a few comments or provide some instruction on how we can best participate in this meeting so that it runs smoothly. Everyone, please make sure you have your microphones or phones muted to avoid background noise. For board members, please make sure your webcam is on so we can see you. For members of the public, if you'd like to speak during the public comment period, you can do so in two ways. First, if you are attending on the Zoom platform, please raise your virtual hand in Zoom. If you are new to Zoom and you've joined our meeting using the Zoom application, click the hand at the bottom of your screen. It should be just off to the right of center. And your hand will turn blue when it's raised. And the second way, if you're joining the meeting via phone, you press *9 on your keypad to raise your hand to make a comment. We will call on individuals who have raised their hands in the order they are raised during public comment period for the project. And then after you're called on, please unmute so you can share your comments. Please state your name and affiliation at the beginning of your remarks. You have a limit of 3 minutes to speak on an item. And please keep your comments respectful and focused. We're here to listen to everyone who wishes to address us, but everyone has the responsibility to act in a civil manner. We will not tolerate hate speech, threats made directly or indirectly, and or abusive language. We will mute anyone who fails to follow these guidelines or who exceeds the established time limits without permission. And finally, every now and then I'll refer to Grace, our BCDC host, who is acting as the host for the meeting behind the scenes to ensure that the technology moves the meeting forward smoothly and consistently. And thank you for your in advance for your patience. Okay. Next item is ex parte communications. Board members, in case you have inadvertently forgotten to provide the staff with a notice of any written or oral ex parte communications, I invite members who have engaged in any such communications to report them at this point by raising your hand and unmuting yourself. Jen, has any board member raised their hand?
Not that I can see.
Okay, thanks. So I know in the published agenda, we have a public comment period. Now we're going to hold that until after the project has been presented. Let's see. And now we're on to staff updates. So as part of the agenda, I'd like to request that our new secretary or our new, the BCDC new engineer, Jen Hyman, I'd like to welcome her to the ECRB meeting ritual here, and looking forward to working with you, Jen. Can you update us on recent activities of BCDC and future meetings that are scheduled for the ECRB?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Chair Yoshida. I would like to provide an update to the ECRB on a few items. On July 26th, next month at 3 p.m., the ECRB will be meeting jointly with the Commission's Design Review Board to get a briefing from the BCDC Planning Branch on the Bay Adapt Program and the Regional Shoreline Adaptation Study. That will be a hybrid meeting held in the BCDC boardroom and on Zoom. A social gathering of both boards will follow, and more information on that will be mailed out to everyone shortly. But do save that on your calendar for July. There's currently nothing agendized for the ECRB July 27th meeting or the August 30th meeting, but please keep those spots on your calendar reserved in case something does come up. On September 27th, we will be meeting to discuss the design of the San Francisco Airport Shoreline Protection Program. As another item, as you know, ECRB member Professor Jack Mulley retired from the ECRB in March, and there has been a posting to fill his position on the ECRB posted on the BCDC website for a month, and we received no applications. The posting stated that a structural engineer employed in public service was preferred. And I did reach out to UC Berkeley, Stanford, San Francisco State, and the Army Corps, but we did not receive any applications. So I suspect that I wrote the posting too narrowly or folks are just super busy. But either way, I'm going to rewrite the posting to simply state that we're looking for an experienced structural engineer and repost it for another month. And hopefully we'll get some applications then. And I'll let everybody on the ECRB know when that gets reposted, as I do appreciate your assistance in recruiting for a new structural engineer to replace Professor Mulley.
All right. Anything else, Jen?
Nope, that's all I have.
Okay. So Grace or Jen, do you have the commendation on your screen for Jack Mulley? I was hoping to read, it's less than a page, but I'd like to read the commendation that the BCDC or the commission is going to give to Jack Mulley or has given to him.
Here it is.
Okay, right. I'd like to you know, personally thank Jack for 11 years of service at ECRB. And I know he set a great example for everyone. So I'd like to, I think it's important to recognize the contributions that Jack has made. And so just hoping to, you'll bear with me while I read the commendation that's been issued. Whereas Dr. Jack Mealy, professor of the Graduate School of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California at Berkeley, has served on the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission's Engineering Criteria Review Board since June 2012 without compensation and without complaint. And whereas Dr. Mealy has provided research and teaching in structural and earthquake engineering over the last 43 years on the faculty of UC Berkeley, where he was the director of the Earthquake Engineering Research Center and the founding director of the Pacific Earthquake Engineering Research Center, has been the recipient of scores of awards and honors, including being elected to the National Academy of Engineering, has provided invaluable contributions to earthquake-resistant design and analysis of building structures, as well as leadership in the engineering, in engineering education. And whereas Dr. Mealy's structural engineering-focused advice to BCDC permit applicants has informed and enhanced the viewpoint of the design criteria and of many shoreline projects, and whereas Dr. Mealy has raised awareness to applicants on seismic hazards in the design of projects inclusive of public access to the bay, and whereas Dr. Mealy vacated his position as a member of the Engineering Criteria Review Board on March 14th, 2023, after 11 years of service, now therefore be it resolved that the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission does hereby unanimously express on the behalf of the entire Bay Area, which it serves, its deepest appreciation and gratitude to Dr. Jack P. Mealy for his generous and distinguished public service over the past 11 years. Signed by R. Zachary Wasserman, the chair of BCDC. So thank you, Jack. I'm not sure if you're here, but we really do appreciate your contributions. Okay, are there any announcements from members of ECRB? Okay, hearing none, I think we're now going to start getting lost in my script here. Okay, the next item is a presentation and discussion of the Greenwood Bay Condominium Seawall Repair Project at 1 Greenwood Bay Drive in Tiburon. So for housekeeping, I think I've asked, and I think all the ECRB members have turned on their video, and you're turn on your microphone when you're speaking or answering questions. And when you're not actively engaged with the board, this other part is for the participants. When you're not actively engaged with the board, please turn off your video so that we minimize distractions on the screen. And now let's introduce the subject of this afternoon's session. Grace, are you promoting everybody on the project team to panelists?
I will now, since you've given the cue.
Okay. And then while that's going on, Jen, do you have some introduction to the project?
Yes, I do. Good afternoon, Chair Iwashita and members of the Engineering Criteria Review Board. My name is Jen Hyman, and I'm the senior engineer at BCDC. Excited to be here for my first meeting. And I'm also serve as the secretary of the ECRB. This will be the board's first review of the Greenwood Bay Condominium Seawall Repair Project, BCDC permit amendment number 1973.015.004. Proposed by the Greenwood Bay Condominium Homeowners Association. I will start with a brief introduction of the project before the applicants present it in greater detail. Sam Fielding, BCDC permit analyst for the project, is also here with us in this meeting. So the 49-unit, three-story condominium complex was originally constructed on Richardson Bay in 1973 under BCDC permit 1973.015.00. At that time, a timber seawall approximately 440 feet long was constructed. It's approximately 20 to 30 feet from the edge of the condominium buildings and faces a narrow tidal canal. That wall is currently beyond its functional life. In 1989, a new timber seawall with tiebacks was constructed on the bay side of that wall, which is also starting to fail at the mudline. A new fiber-reinforced polymer sheet pile wall will be installed on the upland side of the existing timber walls. The old timber pilings and wall will be removed completely, except on the south end where the timbers will be replaced. The applicant has explained that since they consider this project a repair of an existing wall, the new wall height will match that of the existing wall. As a result, the wall is more of a bulkhead than a seawall, holding up the land but not providing 100-year recurrence flood protection. In addition, there is no flood protection on the south or east sides of the condominium complex. As a shoreline protection project, BCDC shoreline protection policies apply, including 1C, addressing erosion control and flood protection. However, the climate change policies do not apply, as it is not considered a larger shoreline project. Here are the questions we would like the board to consider in regards to this project. I'm going to bring them up right now on my screen. We request that the board assess the following questions: whether the design criteria of the site are appropriate for the existing site hazards and conditions, whether current flooding and future rising sea level impacts on the retaining wall are addressed adequately based on the references and the nature of the project, and whether there are any design and physical concerns that have not been addressed. These questions will be discussed further after the presentation. Please make sure any comments during the presentation are clarifying questions. Since the discussion will take place after public comments that follow the presentation. I would like now to introduce you to PJ Cosgrove of the Barnegat Group and Justin Pune, the engineer of record from Simpson, Gumperts and Hager, who will present the project today. And I assume that I will stop sharing my screen so that they can share their screen and present their slides. I'm wondering, Rod, if the ECRB members also got sent copies of the slides in case they have technical issues with Zoom.
I have not had a chance to check my email. I don't believe so.
Okay. Well, if anyone on the board has any technical issues, let me know and I can email them out. Okay. But I'm seeing the slides fine right now.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Yeah, you did send them out, Jen. I do have the presentation.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks.
We'll have to review them.
Good afternoon, Chair Ishida, and thank you, Jen. This is PJ Cosgrove with Barnegat Group. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Well, firstly, thank you for your time in advance to consider our project. 3 years ago, I was retained by the Homeowners Association of Greenwood Bay to assist them in repairing three elements of their marine or of their waterfront project. Two of which are, well, one is a pedestrian bridge that connects the Strawberry Point Bay Trail along, let's call it along the eastern shore of the property, or the eastern shore of the property, and the other is a fishing pier, both of which were submitted through BCDC Water Quality, Fishing Game, Army Corps, the Coast Guard for review and approval, and that project was constructed last year. This project that we have today is the second of what will be the final project of the Greenwood Bay Marine Repairs, and it is, as Jen mentioned, 440 linear feet of existing seawall. As also Jen mentioned, there's two redundant seawalls there, one built in 73, one built in 89. The timber lagging that's in between those two is essentially failing at the mud line. So the proposed project that we have is to replace the failed timbers with a vinyl pile, which SGH has designed, and we have submitted here in front of you, as well as we've also applied. Thank you. Justin is driving the slides behind us. So on the screen in front of you is the seawall itself with the whaler. And as you see at the lower portion of the mud line is the failed timbers. So through my efforts, we've retained SGH as our structural engineer and Anchor QEA as our permit expediter, and as well as the geotechnical investigation was done by RGH consultants. So moving on of a visual, the seawall is on the western side of the Greenwood Bay apartment, or I shouldn't say apartment, the HOA complex, which consists of nine buildings, 49 units total. At the southern end is the pedestrian bridge which connects the Strawberry Point School onto the Bay Trail. And we go to the next slide. So as I mentioned earlier, our first phase was to repair the pedestrian bridge and the fishing wharf, which by through investigation, SGH found to be unsound and unsafe. So they were closed to the traveling public. So we replaced and repaired the existing piles on both structures with an FRP system. And then again, this phase two is the seawall. Our project did not adjacent to the, well, the, well, anyway, let's move on to the next slide. So yeah, here's the seawall project, which we're referring to on the left. On the right is the two projects which were repaired prior. Next slide. So the design by SGH with the seismic parameters of the 2019-2022 code. And like I say, when we initially submitted the project, it was going to be a one permit for the three different elements, but we decided just for the public travel safety to break it into two. So the project was never considered for sea level rise. Currently, the homeowners association has gone to each member through the HOA to solicit funds for this repair. We've solicited contractors. We've selected a contractor who was positioned to start the repair work this summer. We've applied for access through the neighboring church, which is the only access we have to this seawall is on the through the north and on the long to the west side of the property. So we have been given permission to access our property through the neighboring church property this summer. We're currently in review and waiting on approval from the County of Marin for the project. So as you see on the image on the lower portion, that's the only access we have to and from this seawall to remove the existing lagging and to remove the soil that's in place. Our plan is to replace in kind the same planting and vegetation that's currently there. So again, that's just another image of the pedestrian bridge that was repaired last year, and along looking to the north of the existing seawall. When we solicited contractors for the project, historically the seawall or the contractors, the Deal and Marine repairs, were not interested for say in this project because of the limited access. They could not access the seawall via the pedestrian bridge and being the tidal action of the slough that's there. So the contractor we're working with does extensive work in Tiburon and Belvedere area, and the majority of the work will be handled from the land side. Now, if I could introduce Justin with SGH, he will take you through the design criteria of how SGH developed the project.
Just like to jump in here, and if possible, have the speakers turn on their video cameras, if possible.
Can you see and hear me okay?
Oh, yes. Thanks, Justin.
Okay, perfect. Okay. Thanks, PJ. So before I get into the details here, just wanted to quickly mention that I am a structural engineer. I've been working primarily on the structural side of things, but I've got Bill Rudolph here. He's been working with us as a consultant on the geotechnical side of things. He's familiar with the geotech report and the site and has been providing us with guidance and on our approach and design. So Bill, feel free to chime in if needed, or he can answer any geotechnical questions I can't today. So as PJ mentioned, the goal of our work here is to provide a seawall repair design to restore the structural load carrying capacity of the wall without necessarily making any structural improvements or enhancements. So the seawall is actually more of a bulkhead wall than it is a seawall, as there's really no wave action coming in through the channel. But we've kept that terminology to be consistent with the previous repair drawings. The original seawall that you can see here, or in the plan here, kind of highlighted in that orange solid line. It was and is 440 feet long. It was built in 1973, like PJ mentioned, and consisted of timber plumb and batter piles with tie rods and horizontal lagging. The 1989 seawall was repaired with a replacement wall constructed outboard of the original seawall. And that system consisted of two wall types, if you will. You can see in this photo to the right here, segment A and C are a plumb and batter pile system with horizontal lagging and no tie rods. And segment B consists of vertical timber sheet piling with a whale and tie rod. Those tie rods are the same rods used in the original construction and are connected to the building foundations further upland. And so here we have some representative cross sections to graphically describe those systems. The original with the plumb and batter is on the left, and the 1989 repair is shown on the right. And a key thing to note here is that with the seawall repair built outboard of the original, many of those pilings were cut off at the mud line to make way for the repair system. At segments A and C, the new batter and plumb piles were driven between the original demolished piles. All of those original plumb and batter piles occur at about 7 feet on center and are still there today. At segment B, the whale was replaced with a new steel wide flange whale, and the tie rods were extended to connect to those members. So part of our work included an initial site observation to collect information on the current conditions of the 1989 repair system. As you can see in these photos, many of the timber elements exhibit fairly advanced forms of deterioration, primarily due to rot within that tidal zone. So this is especially evident at the vertical timber sheet piling at segment B that you can see here on the right, but also PJ kind of mentioned in the earlier slides. At segment B, the whale also exhibited relatively advanced deterioration. You can see here that the steel is fairly corroded, with some locations even showing fracture, likely due to the continuous wet, dry exposure of the material. And I thought it'd be useful to put things into context by also showing a photo of the typical condition at the existing top of grade. As PJ mentioned, the site features are primarily a walking path and landscaping vegetation, all of which occurs in the backyard of the HOA, which is closed to the public. So the basis of our wall retained height geometry is shown here. The intent of this project is to return the top of grade to the same elevations as previously constructed. So we use the information in this 1988 topographic survey to determine what the top of grade is and wall heights relative to the channel mudline. And so for our repair design, we're conservatively considering the highest retained height along the length of the wall, which is about 5.5 feet. The codes and standards we used include the California Building Code, ASC 716, Army Corps guidance on sheet pile wall design, FHWA guidance on anchored systems. And we use these documents to form the basis of our structural design. And the loads we considered include gravity load for dead and live surcharge, static and seismic earth pressures per the geotech report, and consideration for some hydrostatic tidal lag. The geotechnical engineer on the project, RGH Consultants, provided a geotech report in May 2022. They provided recommendations on earth pressures, seismic parameters, and general site considerations based on their site investigation. The boring log B1 shown here is representative of the general condition at the wall. The composition of the backfill includes an upper layer of heterogeneous fill underlain by bay mud, which starts just below the channel mudline elevation to a depth of about 33 feet below top of grade. And so regarding the seismic parameters, I've provided a few key excerpts here from the geotech report. The PGA is 0.6G. RGH mentions in their report that they judge the potential for liquefaction-induced lateral spreading at the site as being low, and the liquefaction-induced settlements as being up to 3/4 of an inch. But given these recommendations, liquefaction was not really part of our analysis because it was considered so minimal in their report. Our repair wall is generally composed of the same systems throughout the entire 440-foot length of the wall. The proposed repair would be installed landward of the existing 1989 seawall repair, resulting in a net reduction in fill to the bay waters. The wall and the whale will be FRP, and the top 4 feet of the backfill will be excavated and replaced with permeable lightweight fill to reduce the earth pressures on the wall. And the top portion of that backfill will be compacted fill to allow for re-landscaping, essentially. One difference in construction along the wall will be that we're reusing the existing tie rods within segment B, that's that middle section, and that's the only place where those tie rods occur. In segments A and C, it's a little bit of a different current design. So the plan is to excavate and observe the conditions of the tie rods to evaluate them for the suitability of their reuse. And where there are no existing tie rods, such as at segments A and C, only tipping plate anchors will be installed at those locations. After the new system and backfill is installed, the existing timber components will, will be removed down to the mudline. So really quickly, I've just provided some product data here to give you some context on the components that we're using. The products are from Creative Composites Group, and information such as structural capacities, which are listed in their literature with like factors of safety up to 3.0, were used in our design. And so to aid in the handling of the components during construction, you can see here that these sheet piles are fairly lightweight at 4.82 pounds per linear foot of piling. So hopefully that kind of aids in the construction process and the material handling. One big design consideration is deflection of the FRP members. So we made sure to space out our anchors to an appropriate spacing to control the deflection in the whale and the FRP sheet pilings. Creative Composites also has hardware, literature on the hardware, such as splice components to help us with properly detailing our sheet pile wall design. As far as anchors go, We're using the Manoray anchor system, but a substitute such as platypus anchor systems would be acceptable as well. These tipping plate anchors work by driving the anchor into the soil with a small backhoe or a handheld jackhammer and pulling the drive steel out of the ground to right the anchor flute and engage the passive resistance of the soil. Our anchors will be installed at an incline of about 5 degrees downward. And during the installation, if the rods need to be extended, they can be installed with a coupler, and added lengths of rod can be installed as necessary. We use the published load tables to determine the appropriate anchor size. And so for our wall, we're using the largest anchor size available, which is the MRSR model. Our drawings also specify an anchor load testing program based on the FHWA document. We're requiring 2 anchors to be performance tested and the remaining anchors to be proof tested to a design load of 4.7 kips. And as far as sequence of work goes, we provide an example sequence in our drawings to ensure the wall is unloaded and loaded in the correct order. But ultimately, the contractor is going to be responsible for the means and methods, and we'll review their work plans in their submittals. So the example sequence would be to excavate the existing backfill, to unload the existing timber seawall and expose the existing tie rods to assess their condition, drive the anchors, install the couplers as needed, and then perform the load testing, install the FR sheet piling, perform periodic observations to make sure that we're catching any post-construction settlement, and then install the whale and the cap after the wall has stabilized, install weep holes and geotextile fabric and backfill with compacted permeable lightweight fill, and then finally remove the existing deteriorated seawall components. All right, so for our analysis and design approach, we started with a force equilibrium analysis method to determine the required penetration depth of the sheet piling to satisfy the necessary factors of safety for stability. An important thing to note here is that our sheet pile penetration is based on an anchored wall design and not a cantilevered wall design that would require a certain embedment depth to achieve fixity. So the penetration depth here is really just for the passive resistance. The next step in our design was to pick the appropriate size of members based on the published values. We've also been in close correspondence with the manufacturer to ensure that the application of components is appropriate. And then following that, we performed a bit of a more sophisticated analysis PY wall to just verify our results. And then also had an informal review by our consulting independent geotechnical engineer, Bill Rudolph. All right, so as a big disclaimer here, I just want to point out that we're much better engineers than artists. And I realize that the passive resistance shown in this graphic isn't necessarily drawn to scale. This is more schematic than anything to communicate the types of loading we considered in our analysis. So just keep that in mind. We use the values in the geotechnical report, including the seismic lateral pressures. We also calculated the corresponding lightweight fill pressures for use in our analysis. And so here on this slide, you can see the results of our PY wall analysis, which was in pretty close agreement with our force balance approach. The top of wall displacement was calculated to be less than 0.1 inches, and the wall toe deflection is calculated to be 0 inches, just about 0 inches, kind of reinforcing or verifying that the wall will be stable at the design penetration depth. One thing to note here is that our analysis really doesn't account for this extra conservatism of the existing pilings that are present today. In reality, there's going to be 2 wall systems with pilings below the mudline. The original 1973 seawall plumb and batter piles occur at 7 feet on center with a penetration depth of 30 feet along the entire length of the wall. Then there's the 1989 seawall that has majority of its wall length being a continuous system of vertical sheet pilings with a penetration depth of 14 feet. And so we recognize that the remnants of the seawalls that are outboard of our proposed repair will likely provide some amount of additional resistance. But as a conservative measure in our design, we did not include that in our analysis. And since the sheet piling is so light, we expect the skin friction of the new repair to be sufficient to resist the vertical axial load demands on the sheets. And summarizing our design, our factor of safety against overturning was calculated to be 2.86. And all the structural limit states considered were calculated to have a DCR of less than 1.0, thereby meeting the building code requirements. All right, so to close the presentation, here's a recap of our project as discussed today. PJ mentioned that there are a number of site constraints. Water access is impractical due to the channel elevation and the low clearance of the pedestrian bridge, requiring us to have access primarily on land through the neighboring church property. The types of tools to be used will be limited, and as such, our design considered lighter weight materials such as FRP. Sea level rise was not considered, as this project is an amendment to the previous permit, which included repair of a timber fishing pier and a pedestrian bridge that did not consider sea level rise. And the intent of this project is really just to restore the wall with no structural enhancements. The scope doesn't include any new development or upgrades to the complex. We also didn't consider sea level rise because the wall is only along one portion of the west side of the property and doesn't address the remainder of the shoreline where there is no wall. To do so, there would need to be a pretty large engineering and construction and development effort to address sea level rise across the entire property, which the HOA currently does not have the funding for. We also considered seismic loads per the geotech report. Liquefaction was not considered because it was recommended to have a very minimal effect. And our, as a description of our, a recap of our system, it consists of a short 5.5 retain height that's anchored with tie rods and anchors and has a 7-foot piling penetration. The materials will be FRP to allow the contractor to more easily install the components, and our calculated overturning factor of safety and component DCRs are satisfactory and therefore satisfying the building code requirements. And finally, since we're constructing the wall landward of the existing wall, there will be a nut reduction in bay fill. So that's all I have. I guess, Jen, back to you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think after your presentation, Rod will open it up to the public for any questions or comments.
Right. So now we would like to see if there are any public comments. When you are called upon, please state your name and affiliation for the record. Grace, is there any public comment?
I do not see any hands raised.
Okay, so at this point, public comment is closed. Now we'll move on to board discussion. Let's see, I think maybe the thing to do is if you, as an ECRB board member, would like to make a comment, please raise your hand and I will call on you. Bob.
Thanks, Rod. I just had a couple of questions from a coastal loading perspective. I'm guessing that most of the discussion will be geostructural or whatever, and seems like that's already been covered pretty well in the presentation, or very well. But I just had a couple of questions, which I think maybe the applicant could, or their consultant could answer, or we could discuss. So first of all, I'll just go through them. The first one is, does the water level have an effect on the design loads or the structural performance? In other words, if the water level is higher, does it make any difference to the structural design? My second question was answered in the presentation, that there really aren't any wave loads to be concerned about, but I just would like to know, is that by inspection, which, you know, it is pretty sheltered, or has that been documented, and would it make any difference by inspection or otherwise? And my third question is, it seems like this is located on a channel, which I don't know if it's a drainage channel or something, but are there any current loads or currents that could induce scour at the toe? And does that make any, at the base of the wall, and does that make any difference on the passive earth pressure resistance or whatever. And then I think we should talk about sea level rise at some point, but I don't, that's not a question that I have for the applicant right now. So I don't know, Rod, if we should discuss that or just have the applicant respond or.
No, I think it's best to have the applicant respond.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Well, the first question, let's go back to the site view. So does the water level affect the structural loads that are imparted onto the wall? So our design, we intentionally designed it to excavate the existing backfill and replace it with permeable drain rock with a geotextile fabric and weep holes to mitigate that sort of hydrostatic pressure that might build up on the land side of the wall. So we do consider a certain amount of tidal lag below that level of excavation, but we intentionally did that to reduce the amount of hydrostatic pressures on the wall. So hopefully that answers your question on that item.
Yeah, it does actually. That's what I thought. I just wanted to ask and hear your answer. But I think that goes to also the point that perhaps sea level rise within the context of this wall repair design, that perhaps that's not, sea level rise isn't really that pertinent because with a higher water level, as long as you maintain drainage behind the wall, you know, theoretically the soil would be saturated, I guess, or perched behind the wall, and then the tide would drop it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sound like the high water level is really a design criterion. It really just reduces your active earth pressure load in a sense.
Yeah, going back a little bit to, so regarding sea level rise, if the water tidal level would get that high, it would be equal tidal level on both sides of the wall because the remainder of the property, as you can see on the screen here, is exposed to those rising tides. So it's not like you would have a big differential immediately. Right. Regarding waves, so
Justin, let me interrupt real quick. What's the width of your lava rock backfill behind the?
Yeah, so it's cut back at 1.5 to 1, and it's 4 feet deep. So I guess it's 6 feet back. Yeah,
not quite to the bottom of the front face, though.
Right. Yeah, that was just a matter of practicality. So we tried not. I mean, ideally, we would love to excavate all the way down to the channel mud line. But as PJ mentioned, and as you can see in the site constraints, there's pretty limited access, and we're trying to work within reason. So we were able to get the wall to work with this amount of excavation and everything checked out.
This is Bill. I just wanted to add one thing: is that Jim, the reason we didn't excavate all the way to the bottom of the wall is that we were trying to make it so that at low tide level that the excavation wouldn't be filled up with water. We felt that this was an excavation level that was practical, allowed us to reduce the pressures on the wall and to provide a drainage layer, but also not force that excavation down so that we're digging in the wet most of the time. And as Justin has already said, we're putting in some fairly sophisticated filtered weep holes so that we have full long-term positive drainage of the drainage layer. But in addition to that, you know, we have assumed that there'll be a tidal lag within the non-excavated portion of the, sort of below the drain rock. So there is a water pressure difference in that portion. So we've kind of tried to optimize the design from a lowering pressures, but also a construction practicality point of view. Does that answer your question?
It does mostly. Thanks. What's the backfill, the existing fill consist of mostly? USCS, I guess, or something.
What's there now is mainly clay sand, clay gravel. It's a, but it's gravelly, but there's enough fines in it to be relatively impermeable or have low permeability.
Let you finish up with a response to Bob's.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, so it sounds like the drain holes are reasonably low. I mean, I guess the groundwater is probably going to be around mean sea level or something typically, and I don't know exactly where that is. It's probably below the weep holes. So you'll have, at low tide, you'll have some hydrostatic loading going out, with the active earth pressures, I guess. But anyway, going back to my second question was, is there any documentation or what's the basis of assuming there's no waves? Obviously the site is pretty sheltered, but there are, ferry-induced waves that sometimes have more power than you might expect, even though they're small. I'm not sure that's going to control the loading or anything. It doesn't seem like it would, because you have your load is mostly outward and so towards the water, but I just wanted to check on that to see if there was any.
Yes, so we had some internal discussions about what it would mean to have wave loads, whether it makes sense that there would be wave loads. To provide some context here, the channel mud line is around mean sea level. As you can see on this photo, or actually the satellite image on the top left there, there's the mud line extends pretty far out. We're talking hundreds of feet. So I think one sort of rationale for what for the wave loading is that, there would be a certain amount of shallow depth for a pretty great distance outward to the sea. The other thing is that our wall runs parallel to any incoming waves that might be present. So, with all that kind of considered, it was by inspection. There wasn't any analysis per se, but yeah.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question. I appreciate it. And then the last one was that channel. I'm assuming it's some sort of tidal storm drain. It also serves as storm drainage for some inland area or something. Is there any concern about current velocities that could induce scour, or is that an issue with the wall design?
Yeah, that's not an issue that we've observed on site. In fact, actually, we see quite a buildup at the toe.
Yeah.
That was not something that we considered, but that's based on observational data.
Do you account for the passive earth pressure resistance all the way up to the surface or down? Do you have
we
some
do just yes we do our so we recognize that the geotechnical report has values for the bay mud passive resistance that are what we think is somewhat conservative, we do have a triangular distribution at the penetration along the penetration depth. Yeah,
and you also have the piles there and stuff. Okay, well, that answers. Thank you for answering my questions, and I'll keep things moving. Rod, back to you or somebody else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up question to what Bob was asking relative to the drainage inflows into that channel, because I can see there's four culverts that are coming into that channel. Did you do any observations after all of the rain events we had this winter, because I mean, we've had a lot of drought, not a lot of rain, but I was just, this winter was quite unusual with all the inflows. Did you do any observations of how that might have changed conditions since we did get a lot of rain?
Yeah, no, well, we haven't been out on site to observe that specifically. I can say that we did make a site visit back in 2020 after a pretty big storm event. There was nothing that was eye-catching in the channel with regards to that. Hopefully that answers your question.
Okay.
Thanks, Chris. Jim, did you have any further questions?
Yeah, I do. Okay. I have a handful of questions. Hopefully most are pretty simple and easy. First of all, I'm just curious that the end of your presentation says that there was an informal review by Bill Rudolph. And I'm wondering what informal means exactly. And he's the only geotechnical presenter. I don't think anybody from RGH is here. Just curious the relationship to and responsibilities here.
Yeah, we brought on Bill Rudolph to do a review of our calculations, walk through some design concepts, and come up with the most economical and practical design given the site constraints. So informal meaning he wasn't the engineer of record. And yes, RGH is not on the call today, but Bill Rudolph is pretty familiar with the content in the geotech report.
Yeah, I gathered that from what he's said so far.
The only thing I want to add, Jim, is that RGH will will be reviewing the final design, and in accordance with county requirements, will provide a letter that the design is in accordance with their recommendations and provide their stamp. So there will be a formal geotechnical engineer of record review of all this work as well.
Are you going to stay on board as on a retainer basis for questions during construction or whatever?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Liquefaction, the presentation describes that liquefaction impacts to settlement and lateral spreading are minimal and not a concern, and that seems fine to me. It didn't say anything about how liquefaction might affect factor of safety for toe resistance or active pressures, I suppose. Wonder if you could just comment on that.
I'm going to pass that one to Bill.
Okay. First of all, there was a seismic dynamic pressure added to the design. So the additional active pressure due to seismic was added, and I think relatively conservatively. The other thing is that consistent with the geotechnical records recommendation, the passive resistance that was applied for the seismic design was basically equivalent fluid pressure that was based on a very conservative KP value. Whereas
one, it looks like.
Yeah. Whereas in fact, under the seismic condition, the passive pressure is going to be more associated with the, two times the undrained strength of the soil. And so passive pressure is passive resistance for seismic is quite understated in my opinion. Accordingly, any effects of seismic softening that you might expect, some minor reduction in bay mud strength affecting the passive is kind of taken into account by this by the conservative method of assigning passive pressure to the bay mud.
Is there any liquefaction potential within that what's the depth of embedment, 13 feet or something like that?
None whatsoever. It's all bay mud.
Okay. A question about not geotech exactly, but construction sequences. I think you said you're removing the existing wall in front of the new wall. If you said it, I missed it. How deep are you removing that? It goes down quite deep. Are you just cutting things off at or just below the mud line? Are you trying to pull things out or
that's right, at the mud line.
And leaving it in place afterwards. I guess there's right. No concerns. Well, that's not a geotechnical concern to me, I guess then. Okay. Question about, you said the new anchor is going to be put in at 5 degrees, which is pretty flat. And curious a couple of things about that. Curious where groundwater is assumed during, king tides, you're going to get bay water pretty high. Looking at the 100-year flood levels or flood map that I think was included someplace, it looks like the development becomes an island out there, which I assume means that bay water is pretty close to the ground surface out there. Bill commented that the fill soils are clay sands and gravels with low permeability, but clay sands and gravels have variable permeability, and there's likely to be some paths of higher permeability. Right, I would expect groundwater would be somewhere pretty close to the ground surface during highest water, and wondering what that does to the passive resistance in front of your anchor duckbills. Because the soil's going to all be buoyant, and wondering how much that reduces things. I guess, and related to that, then how long are these anchors and how close do they get to the buildings? I know looking at the old drawings, the plan view shows the existing anchors kind of going splaying which direction to miss the corners of buildings and stick a little bit further. Wondering how that impacts them. So those two, I guess, high groundwater with anchor questions with the depth and passive and how close they are to buildings.
Okay, I'll take that. The flat anchor design was trying to balance, the depth of embedment to keep overburden pressures high as possible for the conditions that you're talking about, but at the same time, trying to land this fluke anchor in the fill where we're going to have much higher resistance. So we've used the largest anchor possible to get the largest surface area, and we've tried to keep those anchors from being completely have that bearing surface be completely within the bay mud. So I think with first of all I think that the groundwater condition I think it's unlikely to be all the way to the ground surface clear back within under the building, because we're going to have a tidal situation where the high tide levels are only going to be high for a matter of hours. There's going to need to be some sort of time for seepage to occur and groundwater levels to equilibrate. So I think that the groundwater levels may be within several feet of the ground surface, but I don't think at the ground surface. So while we haven't really specifically gone in and looked at a passive pressure associated with a fully saturated gravelly backfill, we've relied more on the typical design values for these anchors and proof loading to to sort of verify the anchor's capacity in the sort of the as installed condition. We're calling for and expecting, you know, fairly significant factors of safety, which in my opinion should more than likely cover this temporary condition that we might get in the event of high water condition and more gravelly fill than clay fill. And it seems that this is a reasonable design given all the constraints and factors we have to consider.
You're not going to proof test during high water. Question, how long are the anchors roughly? Meaning, in part, I guess, how deep will they be?
They're 18 feet long.
So it'll be, so they're only 2 feet below the ground surface, then, huh?
I think, well, it kind of slopes up a little bit. So there's a little bit more overburden.
Oh, actually, the heads are a foot or two below ground surface. How low is the whale below the ground surface?
The whale itself is 2.5 feet below.
2.5, okay. And the ground slopes up and the anchor slopes down. So it might be 4 or 5 feet down. So like Bill said, it's going to be getting pretty close and you have to be that flat, or otherwise you're bedding your anchor into the bay mud.
Right.
Okay, makes sense. Let's see, I think I've got, that's all my questions, except I think we're going to come back at some point. I'm curious about high water and sea level rise, and you're pretty darn close, and just curious about, you know, before too long, this place is going to have water in the basements, and that's not a geotechnical, it's more of a policy decision, I guess, but no, that's the end of my questions then, otherwise.
Okay, thank you, Jim. I wasn't sure who was next up. Is it Dilip or Thalia?
So I'll go. A couple of questions. I was looking at the sequencing diagram, you know, the slide that you had. You know, what I noticed is that there's about a 1 foot between the existing wall and the new FRP sheets, is that right? About 12 inches or so is the proposed separation. And my question there is, so when are the anchors going to be installed? Sequencing says that the wall is going to be removed, the existing wall at the very end. So are the existing anchors driven in through the existing wall right now, as you have planned?
No. So the plan is to excavate behind the wall first, drive the sheet, install the anchor, you know, I guess not connected to the existing wall, but behind the existing wall, since we've already excavated back. So that'll happen likely maybe right before you put in the sheets, or it could happen after the sheets.
Okay. All right. My second question was, you know, yeah, I was getting more to what Jim was heading towards. So it's been designed for 5.5 feet stick up. So thinking about project life, I mean, I can imagine that these condos are not going to go away in the next 10 or 15 years. And so there probably will be a project in the future that will come back, which will be either extending the existing wall or having another wall. Unless they are planning to raise grades, which again, I see, you know, not being doable. So what is the thought process there, given that if you look at the projections that BCDC has been using, which is 2 feet in the next 30 years, which are the projections we are being asked to use, there very likely will be a future project coming here in the short term, looking at increasing the height of this existing wall that is being going in.
Yeah. And PJ, feel free to chime in if you want. But from what I understand, the conversation on sea level rise and how to address it across the entire property has just not occurred within the HOA board or within the residents. It's not something that they have the funding for right now or the time for. I think this project came up because they observed a certain amount of damage at the existing timber sheet pile wall. So the idea is to just restore the capacity of that. But beyond that, I don't believe that the scope of that project has really been discussed by the owner.
Yeah, but that's not my question, you know, to address sea level rise. But the same configuration of the wall will very likely be extended upwards. And so is there enough reserve capacity for this to act with a 7.5 feet stick up instead of a 5.5 feet stick up? And is the FRP, does it lend itself to adding on to it and attaching another FRP sheet to it?
So in terms of, let's say, a rise in hydrostatic loads, the hydrostatic loads would be equal on both sides since, you know, it's the wall is only for a portion of the western shoreline. So we expect that any tidal rises would kind of, you know, be equally matched on both sides. So in terms of loading, we're not too concerned with that, but we've done some back of the napkin calcs to see, you know, if there is a small amount of differential pressure on the sheet pile, it would simply just require a different sheet pile size. But currently this is designed for, you know, not necessarily a 50 year life, but, you know, the last sheet pile wall was repaired 1989 after 1973. Then here we are, you know, not quite a 50 year. So yes, that question could come up in the future.
All right. No, I think that's all I had. Thanks.
Thank you, Dilip. Thalia?
Yes. I wanted to go back to the issue of liquefaction and ask a couple of questions that were not clear to me from the report, from the geotechnical report. So I see that there are three explorations in the geotechnical report. One of the CPTs suggests presence of liquefiable soils or silty sands susceptible to liquefaction with low tip resistance at depths of approximately 6 to 9 feet. And there is a statement in the report that liquefiable soils are present behind the wall. So I was not very clear how the conclusion that the lateral spreading is negligible and shouldn't be taken into consideration, how this conclusion was arrived at, given the relatively sparse explorations and the fact that one of those suggests that there are liquefiable soils behind the wall above the mud line. So I guess the question is, could you maybe in a cross section of the wall show where the liquefiable soils were encountered? And then the second, is this conclusion really based on an understanding of what is the composition of the field from, you know, construction or historical documents other than the existing explorations, which are quite sparse?
Might want to pass that over to Bill.
Well, I think what you're getting at is really looking at the global stability of the shoreline. Mm-hmm. Really, this project has really only really been focused on the replacement of the wall, which is really, you know, it really doesn't consider or even look at the overall seismic stability of the shoreline. It's just a replacement of a bulkhead in the condition that it existed. I think that, you know, the consideration of, you know, sort of overall shoreline seismic stability and deformation is, you know, kind of beyond the scope of what was is being has been looked at and studied in this particular case. The presence of liquefiable layers within the bay mud at 20 some odd feet is really doesn't really affect the wall design per se. That's much more of a global stability issue.
I think if this is the case, it's probably, you know, the statement in the report, which in the geotechnical report, which suggests that lateral spreading is negligible given the presence of liquefiable soils. Probably the statement should be changed to it's beyond the scope, the design scope of this project, because I don't see that the calculations or the background is there to rule out this hazard or potential hazard.
No, I agree with you. And it that sort of escaped my view because, like I say, we were pretty much focused on the wall replacement. But I think that that is a, you know, maybe we can request in the geotechnicals review of the project plans and what you just stated that be clarified that this isn't within the scope of the work. I think that's something that can be done and makes sense to me.
That was my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Talia. I've noted that as kind of a point of action after this meeting. Ramin?
Hello, everyone. I'd like to go back to the question that Jim asked, which is still an issue in my mind. Bill, who I have known for many years and respect, you are the face of the geotechnical response on this presentation. And are you a peer review? Are you going to at some point have some sort of a document saying that you concur with this design, you agree with the conclusions, et cetera? So that's one question. And the other question that I have has to do with these anchors. And my concern is long-term creep issues with sustaining the loads. These things are not very, they're not very robust, I would say. So those are the couple of questions I have.
So the answer to the first question is that I think it's important to note that the geotechnical engineer of record will ultimately sign off on the design and the use of their recommendations from the report. I have, as you know, I've had a long relationship with SGH and others, and have provided them with review and sort of opinions on a lot of different projects. If I'm asked to provide a peer review letter, if that's appropriate in this case, I'm happy to do that. But I have no problem with that at all. So if that's the first question. Kind of my stuttering around a little bit talking to Jim is that the anchor design is, I believe, is really kind of trying to balance a number of different things. Accessibility, coming up with a tieback anchor that's constructible, and trying to get an anchor that we can get a reasonable capacity out of, but and locate in a way that it's bounded within the fill. My sense is that if we're able to, which I think we should, able to put these anchors within these clay gravel, that the creep behavior of the anchors should be fine. I think if we're landing anchors within bay mud, we're going to see problems with capacity, and we may have creep problems. On the other hand, we got to keep in mind that we're going to do both proof and performance tests on these anchors. And the proof tests will have a creep test on the anchor. So we will, I think all those things combined should address that concern about creep.
And one other thing, do you have any concerns? Because the way, at least if you go back to the section of the wall that shows the anchor, mm-hmm. How are you going to install this? I mean, it seemed like the way I understood it is these are being pushed into the ground, some distance, 18 feet or so. And how are you going to, how is that going to be done?
Hang on a second. Justin can add on, because I think he's talked to the contractors, but my understanding is that these anchors are going to be installed in relatively short sections with couplers, and they'll probably be installed with a basically a handheld jackhammer type unit. And so I think the idea is that the that there's going to be this excavated pit sort of behind the wall. I really am not exactly clear on the precise dimensions of that, but I'm understanding that they're going to install these anchors from in this pit in relatively short section. So I don't know looking at the dimensions, I don't know what the dimensions of that clearance between the back of the pit, that the face of the existing wall and the back of the pit are, but
it's about 7 feet or so, let's say.
Yeah, so it's possible that they may have to come in and, you know, excavate something other than that 1.5-to-1 slope at the anchor location to provide, you know, more clearance in order to install these anchors from within that pit. And then what will happen is there'll be a coupler that's kind of shown in the picture near the face of the wall. And then there'll be a short connector piece that'll.
All right. So this, the wall is coming after the anchor. That's the sequence then.
Right.
So you will have, so if I look at this drawing here, this green section is not going to be there. There's going to be a slope cut there, and this anchor at whatever location it needs to be is going to be jackhammered into the ground, and then a section is kind of sticks out and backfilled around, and then the wall is constructed, right?
Justin,
that's right.
Yeah, and I may have misspoken earlier when I was saying that the wall might be able to be installed before, but that's right. That's the concept.
Okay, all right. So that I was thinking, how are you going to get into that little slot there to install these? Okay.
I mean, I envision that the temporary excavation to accomplish this is not going to be this 1.5-to-1 slope. It's going to be a bench and some larger slope back. They're going to need more room at the anchor locations, but you know, and that a lot of
not be able to hold that slope either at 1.5-to-1. Maybe
that's all
flatter.
It could need to be flatter. You know, the a lot of these issues were are somewhat means and methods, but I understand we need to have a concept that's buildable. But I do agree with you that possibly some of the details of the temporary excavations to make this work are not well reflected in the schematics that we have.
And one last question. Are these anchors design build, or how does that work? Or you are specifying SGH?
We are currently specifying it.
Okay.
Let me be correcting that a little bit. It is design build, and that they're able to substitute another anchor type, and there is a performance criteria in terms of ultimate capacity and creep that have to be shown in the proof test. So they're specifying the location and general function of the anchor, but the actual anchor itself is design build.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Rene. Jima?
Thank you, Rod. So I wanted to go back to the question about the liquefiable layer that Talia raised. And I agree with her that I think we need to have a section, showing what the potential liquefiable layer thickness is, relative to this section that we are looking at. I wanted to ask Bill, let's say if we have about a three-foot thick liquefiable layer, do you foresee any potential issues relating to a drag due to liquefaction-induced settlement in that layer adjacent to the sheet pile?
A drag. I think there could be because there's several things going on here. First of all, settlement, just pure settlement without any lateral translation, is just going to cause the whole system to basically settle as a unit. I can't see that anything's going to be held up and have a drag or a down drag load occur because of that, because the liquefiable zone in that case will be entirely below the new construction. From a practical point of view, with regard to the impact of liquefaction of the layer, which I haven't really focused on, it's to a certain extent, the slope is not that high. We only have a 5-foot slope, and it's perforated with timber piles that penetrate that layer. So the slope to a large degree is pinned. So just sort of logically, it seems that even if there is some liquefaction and factors of safety against global stability are somewhat lowered, that the amount of movement that can really occur because of the pinning effect of these double piles every 7 feet along the whole way, it seems like certainly I can't say that I've analyzed it or there's enough information to analyze it, but it just seems that conceptually that it's not a configuration that seems to have a very high risk in my view.
Okay. Has there been any signs of distress in terms of bulging out of the wall? Well, things have remained fairly vertical for the existing.
Yes. Yeah. We didn't witness any signs of bulging. In fact, actually at the mud line, you can see that some sections are at 100% loss and the wall is still perfectly plumb and intact.
Okay. All right. My second question relates to this detail that we are looking at. The lightweight material that is shown there, is that the same material that you are counting on to serve as a drainage material?
Yes, it is. this material is, we're actually specifying this material to come from Lake County, lightweight material. And it is specified and produced as a drainage material. Very popular as a drainage material throughout the vineyard industry, believe it or not. And the reason that they produce this drainage material out of lightweight material is because it reduces the transportation costs immensely for these large drainage projects. So they do provide, the supplier does provide spec sheets and showing that it is a certified drainage material.
Okay, so I assume then that is basically poorly graded material.
Pardon me, sorry, I missed that.
Poorly graded material.
Yes, it's poorly graded material. It has low fines content.
Yeah.
Right. It does have some fines content, but nonetheless, that's one of the reasons that we've actually specified these filter. They're fairly sophisticated filtered weep hole apparatus that's going to be installed to make sure that we don't have any dredging or fines loss of the small fines content through the weep holes.
Okay. Great. So the compacted fill for landscaping, is that plantain soil or what kind of material is that?
We're specifying that to be a material, I can't remember the exact spec, but basically I think it's supposed to have, probably 15-20% passing a 200. It's meant to be not only landscaping, but it's meant to be a low permeability cap.
No.
20% fines or greater.
Yeah, so it's just gonna, there'll be a geotextile fabric to prevent the fines from migrating into the drainage material. The cap is meant to keep surface runoff out of the drainage material and also to provide a media for planting.
Okay, that's wonderful. So my last question relates to the passive pressure, which you discussed with Jim. Mm-hmm. Quite a bit. I was kind of wondering, are you looking at, in determining the passive pressure, are you looking at, how much of the, whatever the maximum passive pressure is, how much of it is actually mobilized, given the performance of the system?
That was done that was modeled using the PY wall model, which replaced the which used the passive resistances to develop a passive spring resistance in the PY wall model. So there was both a limit equilibrium model used, which did not look at mobilization of passive pressure but just looked at factors of safety. And then the design was invalidated or checked against this mobilization model using the PY wall model.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Bill.
Sure. Thank you. Good questions.
thank you, Jima. Justin?
Yes, thanks. Couple questions and comments. My first question is, what is the anticipated lifespan of the new wall? How long is it designed to be in place?
Given past history, I would say probably 30 to 40 years.
Okay. And just to follow up on Dilip's comment about extending the wall, is that something that's even possible with the current design, and what modifications would be required that might allow that to occur in the future?
Yeah. So We're not aware currently of any splicing sort of connection or device that you can use. But one thing to kind of keep in mind is that this is on a very short portion of this western side of the property. This channel extends all the way down here. So whatever the results are of any future global engineered sea level rise study might have an impact on the type of wall selection that you have further up the stream. So I think that can certainly be considered in a couple of different ways, new wall, or maybe at the time there's a way to splice it on, but that's not something that we've considered at this point.
Okay. And then from your cross section, it does look like the wall will extend higher than the land side, but behind the wall, right? What is that height above the ground behind the wall?
This height here?
The height of the top of the wall relative to the compacted fill for landscaping.
Yeah, so I think it's about a foot to a foot and a half, maybe closer to a foot and a half.
Okay. Yeah, because I was just thinking your comment about sort of water levels being the same on both sides. I'm not sure if that would necessarily be the case, because the ground seems like it slopes up to where the condos are. So during a high tide event, I think it's possible that the water level could be, like, say, just at the crest of the wall, but that the area behind it would not be inundated until it overtopped. So I think there could be a case where there could be that additional loading on the water side.
I see what you mean. I think the perspective that I was thinking of is water inundation coming from this side.
Right. Okay.
And from this side.
Kind of around the flanking the wall.
Not necessarily perpendicular to the wall. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then just to comment, I agree with the discussion about probably negligible waves coming from the bay, but during a storm surge event with even just a small amount of sea level rise, if you look at the BCDC flood maps, there's actually sort of an interior embayment created by that flooding to the west and to the northwest. And so with the right wind direction, there could be some small waves that are sort of generated from the interior side. And I don't think they would be large enough to cause any issues in terms of, like, loading, but they could sort of spill over and maybe scour some of the backfill or the vegetation. So I just wanted to note that they're during a, you know, based on current topography, that there would sort of be this water body out there to the west, and that there could be some waves generated from that direction.
Understood. Yep. And I got the figure here. It's 1.1 feet of stick up height beyond the
back. Okay. Okay. So. And then just to confirm, it sounded like you were saying that water would be able to drain through the wall from the backside. Like if inundation occurred or overtopping occurred, that when the tide receded, that water wouldn't be trapped behind the wall, that it would be able to seep back out. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. And then the note about reusing the tie rods. Those are originally installed in 73, so they're already 50 years old. Are you anticipating to be able to get another 30 to 40 years of life out of those?
I think it really depends on our site observation. It's something that we put as a requirement in our drawings to excavate, expose, and inspect the current condition of it. There might be ways to mitigate the current damage by replacing sections of it with a new section and a coupler rod. But we'll certainly have to address that once we're in the construction phase.
Okay. And then just to comment, like, my experience with the public is that something that looks like a seawall, people think it is a seawall and, like, a flood wall. So I just wanted to, you know, note that the homeowner should be made aware that this is not a flood protection wall. It's a retaining wall. And I understand why you're using the term seawall based on the past permit and everything, but I just think that that should be made clear that that replacing this is not actually acting as a flood protection structure.
Understood. Noted. Yeah.
And then my last question, I thought I noted on the drawings or and read in the report that the existing wall and piles would be removed, but then I thought you said that maybe they would stay in place. So just can you clarify what's kind of staying and what's being removed on in front of the new wall?
Sure. So this is kind of an exhausted topic at this point, but there are two walls. So there's the 73 wall and then the 89 wall. So to it's a good question to clarify what's going on currently is the 1973 plumb and batter piles are cut below the mud line, or in some cases at segment B, the plumb pile is sticking up above the mud line, but the batter is cut. So that's what's there right now. For the current 1989 seawall repair that's in place, the plan is to cut that off at the mud line. So for any segment, like say the 73 plumb pile that's still there or the horizontal lagging, that would also be removed to the mud line.
Okay. So no components of the prior walls would exist? Because I thought you said something about like in the analysis that there would be these piles that would be there, but you didn't take credit for them.
Yes, right. Yeah. So what I'm referencing there is the amount of piling that exists below the mud line.
Oh, I see.
So okay. In terms of the passive resistance of the sheet pile toe, there's actually going to be something there, but it's not something we considered in our design.
Got it. Okay. Thanks. Those are all my questions.
Thank you, Justin. So just let me jump in real quick, because I think it was what you had. One of the questions that I had was the design life. And is that noted anywhere in calculations or basis of design?
We do not have that noted anywhere.
Okay. I think I'd recommend that you put something in there or amend something or add an amendment that does mention that. Chris May.
Yep. Yeah, I had a question on the design life as well. I understand that the timber structures, you know, had a 30-year design life or less, but you're using a material specifically so it will have a longer design life. So I think 30 years is probably too short of a design life for the material choice, which makes me question the sea level rise and groundwater conditions in the analysis. I know other people have brought up. I know you've stated that, you know, this development would need to consider a much larger strategy to address sea level rise, which would be expensive, but that's the same situation it is for every project around the bay. And most of them do it in a stepwise adaptation fashion. So if this project did include sea level rise for at least a 50-year design life, then you've addressed sea level rise for 30% of the shoreline of the development area. So you're giving them quite immense a benefit for their future plans. And this area is very vulnerable to both sea level rise and rising groundwater. So I'm wondering if there was at least some kind of estimate of what it would cost to have this address like 2 feet of sea level rise. Maybe that's using a thicker wall material so that it could provide a higher degree of protection, which would also allow it to provide some protection from the existing, 100-year flood event, which this wall doesn't currently cover. Yeah. Is that looked at all in the design?
That's a good question. So the choice of the material, while it is very durable, it's kind of secondary to the main reason, which was site access and, material handling, constructability. In regards to design life, what we've seen is, yes, the timber elements are rotting at this this point, but also the steel elements are. And there are some steel components like the anchors, which, you know, we'll observe when we get into construction, but also the new ones that might be susceptible to that same sort of design life. So that's kind of where our sort of perspective was on that. In terms of raising the wall, I mean, that can certainly be an option. It's not something that we've considered, as, you know, we're really just trying to replace the deteriorated wall. But, you know, that I think that's a much larger conversation than what we've had. It's something that the HOA needs to kind of determine what they're going to do globally. But yes, I understand your question and your comment.
Yeah, if they're not considering managed retreat, it would be good to address it, you know, at some level with this project, so they can understand that they're making a wise investment.
Right.
Anything? Oh, okay. Thank you, Chris. Jim, you have another question?
Sorry to recycle back. I have just one more question, I think. And that's, I don't know that I've heard anything mentioned about corrosion, that corrosion is specifically excluded from the RGH scope. Obviously, for the FRPs, corrosion per se is not an issue. I guess at some point they start to age, but the anchors are metal, and I think, believe they're galvanized and designed for me. Designed for some corrosion, but this environment is pretty salty and pretty aggressive.
I'm sorry. So is the question?
So the question is, how has corrosion been addressed? Corrosion of the anchors in particular, and of the whale, I guess.
Right.
Any metal components?
Yeah. So we do have some margin of factor of safety. Or not factor of safety, I'm sorry, the demand to capacity ratio to allow for any material degradation. It can be considered addressed there.
I think it's not appropriate to address it by factor of safety. I think you need to address it by number of inches of material loss you're going to get over whatever the design life is.
Right.
And or the thickness of the galvanizing to protect against that. And if there's going to be any damage of the galvanizing as it's driving through through gravel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't have a actual prescribed, you know, inch per or, you know, measurement per span of life. But I can't say that we have a margin within our demand to capacity ratios.
Rod, that's the end of my questions, I guess. I have, you know, like we often end up with, at some point we need to talk about, are we just approving it as is, or we have any requests, or do you want to see them again? I have a couple of requests that I'd like to have them address at some point. I'm not sure if this is the time or if you want to.
Well, I have a few questions myself. I think I've learned from last time I was running one of these meetings. I asked all my questions up front that, the shoreline, quite the folks with the sea, not the seawall, but the somebody help me out here. Cargill, thank you. At the Cargill. So I do have a few questions. And I guess, you know, the easy one is, is the material for the sheet pile UV stabilized? And is that something that you'd be worried about?
From what I understand, yes, but I'd have to go back to Creative Composites to address that, whatever specific question you have.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping that there is some component of UV stabilization so the thing doesn't get brittle and you have a failure.
No. Right. And I have discussed in the past whether they have certain coatings that they would recommend. And I know that there are options on that front.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then this is, I think, a good slide to have up, but I was curious about the returns, you know, retaining walls. Sometimes, and I think it's good practice to have returns at the ends of the seawall or of a retaining wall that kind of contain the forces. And I noticed that the tie rods don't appear to continue at both ends of the retaining wall. And I was just hoping, is it that you're going to continue to use batter piles in those locations, or is there some other way that it's being fixed at each end?
Yes. So segment B, let me go back to the plan. Segment B is this middle portion here that already has the tie rods.
Yeah.
There's additional anchors that are being placed between those. Okay. And where it doesn't occur at segment A and C, the idea is that we would just drive anchors throughout.
Okay. And then, you know, I don't know that this is for you, the designer, but are you going to recommend some sort of long-term monitoring program that looks at the displacement of the wall and perhaps, you know, indications of anchor or tie rod failure?
Bill, you might be able to shed some light here, but as it currently stands, we're not requiring one or recommending one.
My feeling is that there should be some monitoring to look at the sort of the long-term performance of the wall, not only to checking the plumbness of the wall, and I think it's important that these weep holes are maintained. The particular product that we are have specified is is designed to be maintainable, and so a lot of fouling can occur and those can get clogged up. So I think there should be some guidelines given to monitoring and maintenance of the system over time.
Yeah, I would think so as well. What is the kind of typical or standard tension in the anchors? Are they going to be, post-tensioned after they've been tested, or are they set at slack tension?
There are just a couple of performance tested anchors, but then the rest of them are all proof loaded. And the idea there is to kind of monitor any creep. So it you are kind of engaging that passive pressure and then locking it off.
So, yeah. And do you know, do you have what's the design lock off load, I guess?
4.7 kips.
Okay. Okay. And that's.
Well, that's the design load. Yes. Yeah.
4.7 kips. So you're locking it off after your proof testing at 4.7 kips.
Right. And Bill, you might be able to chime in here, but it's a cyclic loading. So you actually exceed the 4.7 kips at times, but then you kind of relax.
My understanding here is that they're going to be tested to that design load.
Yeah.
But I do think they're going to be just snugged up, and I don't think they're going to be locked off at any load.
Okay.
I think they're just not slack, but just snug, not preloaded.
Yeah, that's the question I was thinking about, is that when the contractor is off the job, what's the tension in the anchor rods?
Right.
It's just snug. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, any working tension in the rods will be associated with sort of the active and passive pressures develop, and with some small, slight movements of the wall to actually engage those pressures and hence the tensions in the rod. So, we don't have a super strict wall movement tolerance here. So I think that they're going to be just locked, just snugged up and left in that condition.
Yeah. And then I know Justin and Chris talked about it a little bit, but I just was going to ask in a way that that I was thinking about it. Are there going to be scuppers, you know, basically at where the fill and wall are, you know, kind of meeting so that you can drain, you know, say an extreme precipitation event? Or or are you just retaining, you know, that 1.1 foot of water that can build up in a big rain event?
Right. Yeah, it's just the 1.1 feet of water.
And that's been accounted for in the design?
Yes. Yeah, we have a certain amount of hydrostatic load. Are you talking about at the top or?
Yeah, we want to find a slide that shows the section. So that between the compacted fill for landscaping and the top of the FRP sheet pile,
mm-hmm.
that's a inverted triangular load of water there. Has that been accounted for in your design?
Yeah, our analysis assumes that it's permeable, so there's a way to drain through.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So a scupper.
My understanding is that there is existing surface drainage on the property, and that surface drainage, which will, you know, collect and discharge the water, will have to be maintained so that, you know, I don't think we're going to go there and have, you know, ponded water occurring behind here, but the surface drainage is going to have to be, will be addressed in the final analysis, I think.
Okay. Yeah, but if you're excavating for anchors every 7 feet, are you then disrupting whatever surface drainage you've got, or just wondering how that water gets out?
No, I think you're right. It's going to be disturbed, but it's going to have to be, you know, the grades that. It's my understanding is that it drains now, and that ultimately when it's all backfilled, that the positive surface drainage is going to have to be restored as part of the landscaping and final backfilling operations.
I think that's what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So I'm assuming that is not part of the design as yet, right? So I think that's the end of my questions. And I think Jim's right. Like, we have to kind of decide now whether or not we want to hear back from you, or whether or not, you know, the board is satisfied with the responses. And maybe if the requests for information that we've made are addressable by, you know, transmitting, by SGH transmitting, or the applicant transmitting responses to those outstanding questions to BCDC. What does Bob, you get, and Jim, you get, Bob, you get your hand up.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to jump in to start the discussion. It seemed to me that what I heard, there were comments on, you know, there probably should be some sort of discussion by the community or the neighborhood about sea level rise and what's going to happen in the future, and that may not be part of this project, or it might be something that there'd be some notification of that. Also, as Justin indicated, it's not a seawall, it's a retaining wall, and that's why more of a bulkhead, I guess, and that's why the water level didn't seem to be a driver. Rod, based on what you just said, it sounds like the wall loading should have loading all the way up to the top of the wall, you know, soil or water or something, you know, or you know, whatever the worst condition is for the largest active load on the wall, because you know, it's going to either have water behind it or soil behind it at some point, probably. And I didn't review it closely enough to see if they consider that. And then there's the question about the project life. So in my opinion, if those things are addressed, I don't think we need to see it again. Myself, I mean, I don't, just from my perspective, it's like a civil coastal, but I'll just throw that out there and let's see if somebody else
Jim has his hand up as well.
So I would probably be inclined to agree with Bob that I know that the ECRB needs to see this again, but I do have several topics that I think should be addressed by the design team prior to approval and probably resubmitted to BCDC for staff review, just to say, yeah, it's been addressed. If you know, what we've done in the past is if the staff still feels that the responses are beyond their expertise, then we can weigh in again. But I'm not inclined to think we need to at this point. Let's see, first point was related to liquefaction, kind of raised by liquefaction and global stability and some related issues that Thalia started with, to indicate that somewhere, and I think Bill was agreeing with this, that somewhere it would be appropriate to indicate that the global stability and lateral spreading really are beyond the scope of their specific analysis, and they're just looking at the retaining wall stability, and that should be probably documented. And Thalia noted that there was, it looked like there was some liquefaction within the wall depth. It's kind of interesting that the Geotech report plates, let me just see what the plate numbers are, of 4 and 5 of the Geotech report, I think, are output from a computer program called CELIC, called CELIC for cone penetration test liquefaction analysis. But they don't show the results of the liquefaction analysis. They do show the results of the thin layer correction. And so you can see that it looks like there are some zones within a couple of feet of the toe of the sheet piles that there is liquefaction, material types and low that are liquefiable and bone penetration resistance values that are pretty low. And I sub C values that are pretty low. So all around, it looks like there's Thalia's nodding. So that's an amen, I guess, to that. But I think there is liquefaction. I think that the Geotech report should include the extra plots from CELIC that show where liquefaction is actually occurring. And the design team then should explicitly look at the impact of liquefaction on the wall stability for passive pressure. In particular, if it's going to affect active pressure as well, and that should be documented. I don't know that it's that difficult to do, that we need to review it again, but I think that ought to be, in terms of engineering criteria, it should be that they should document that have evaluated liquefaction rather than showing the CELIC report without showing the CELIC output. And then include a comment explicitly that the liquefaction will not affect wall stability. I think somewhere they need to document what the design life is of the project, and probably document someplace a statement about sea level rise. However they want to document it, that it's not considered or that it'll handle the next 4 years of sea level rise, or that sea level rise has already exceeded what this project is really going to guard against, or whatever, but provide some sort of documentation that describing sea level rise and how it relates to the project. I think probably the design needs to explicitly address corrosion, whether that means that SGH needs to go back and take some samples for corrosion potential and then document it, or whether some conventional numbers out of, you can almost assume that it's buried in seawater or in bay water. And I think there's some standard values for corrosion potential in that. But in some way, corrosion, I think, needs to be explicitly addressed. in the design, both in what the demand is, as well as how to mitigate the risk from corrosion. And then Rod mentioned UV resistance, and somehow there needs to be a documentation that that the FRP will adequately handle UV. And this isn't really a required comment, I guess, but just to note that I would recommend that the lock off is probably more than a nominal seating value, but probably 50% or something like that, so that you don't encourage movement to happen before the wall takes up. But I'm open to whatever. Bill's done this more than I have, I'm sure. And then someone else commented, I guess, that it's a retaining wall, not a seawall. That's what I had.
Okay. That was pretty complete. Exhaustive. Are there other items that the board would like to see addressed in the applicant's response letter to BCDC? Ramin?
Yes, I would like to have a official position on this project for Bill. I mean, honestly, today Bill is the face of the geotechnical aspect of this project, and that needs to be formalized in whatever way that the team thinks is appropriate.
Okay, Justin?
Just wanted to confirm that one of the notes was about loading on the wall, either assuming the water side is at the crest and it's dry on the land side, and the reverse of that, and that there's some clarification of the plan to accommodate drainage from behind the wall of water that could get ponded back there, either from overtopping by marine waters, waves, or the accumulation of rainfall runoff from behind the wall, and that there's a way to either drain it through the wall, or that the grading behind the wall can allow it to, I guess, drain north-south somehow. My sense from looking at the pictures is that maybe the current drainage, it just goes through the wall because it's the timber wall and there's gaps, and I don't think that will be the case with the new FRP wall.
Okay. Jen, did you get all of that? Is there anything else? I think these were all, Bob?
I think I got it.
Okay.
Yeah, as we were talking, I was thinking that the statement about sea level rise, just to clarify, could be like Jim and Chris were saying, in terms of, you know, future adaptation and whether or not what vertical capacity the wall has, and, you know, like how many feet of sea level rise we think the wall could handle. And, you know, I think specifically what Chris was getting to before was, you know, does it make sense to build something bigger now? Because the incremental cost might be favorable. So, and that's probably over the consultant's head, but it might be something that we might want to mention for the owner's benefit. I don't know if Jen got that, but that's kind of all like the sea level rise thing, dealing with that.
I'm hoping that the owner or the HOA, you know, is thinking about this, but it is, I don't know. They're on a little peninsula, right? And when sea level rise comes, I think managed retreat has been mentioned. That phrase has been mentioned a few times. You know, I don't want to point out or make inflammatory statements, but if there was a place to see managed retreat, you know, I'd be assuming that it's on a little peninsula like this.
You know, there may be other adaptation strategies, which I have no idea about the economic viability of this, but maybe they could put the homes on piles, or, you know, build new ones on piles, or floating homes, or I don't know. I mean, but I just feel like, you know, just from a, you know, they're coming to BCDC and they're not, you know, it's not considering sea level rise, it's called a seawall, but I just kind of feel like we should say something like, hey, you guys are vulnerable to sea level rise. Probably obvious, and but if not, there's some resources, and you might want to think about whether or not you do want to invest a little bit more in this wall to save you money later in your adaptation plan. Chris, is that, you're probably better at this than I am in terms of, does that make sense to you? That
absolutely makes sense to me. Yeah, okay. I think they should consider that incremental cost so that they, you know, could potentially be solving, you know, a portion of their sea level rise problem in the long run. I mean, I know it's just a piece of the shoreline, but every bit helps.
Yeah, and then on the other hand, of course, this is real money for a homeowners association. So, you know, actually, I feel like the sea level is not directly a design criteria for this project. It's more of an indirect criteria in terms of the loading as it relates to drainage, I believe is with, and so I think I feel okay with not including sea level rise criteria, but I'm uncomfortable without clarity that somebody acknowledges that that's an issue that's apparent.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I'm, and I think, thanks for that other perspective, because I think if I were the HOA, I'd be saying, I got to pay how much for this? And I'm paying, you know, extra, I'm paying extra now for a location that I'm probably not going to be in 30 years. What, you know, so I think I don't want to split the baby, but I would think that, you know, if there's some sort of actual statement on sea level rise and whether or not it's, I guess they've already said that it's not approved or not part of the design criteria. I'm not sure that, and that they recognize that the design, I think that's why this design life thing is important, because you can then say, okay, we recognize that we've kicked the can down the road, and, you know, in 2050, we have a real problem, or we have to come back and address another problem. And I think that's explicit here, then
that's a good point. I mean, they've probably heard this discussion, so
yeah,
I'm
assuming.
Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt, but okay. I was just, I agree, however you want to say it. I was just trying to clarify.
Yeah, sure. One last thing here. I mean, it is a requirement of the permit application, right? And so I'm just looking for guidance to us for future projects which come in with, say, we are not addressing sea level rise because this is a repair project. Well, most projects with shoreline improvements are repair projects. And so, you know, what is the precedent that we are setting for ourselves by looking at any shoreline repair project as not accommodating sea level rise? So I think that issue needs to be addressed, maybe not ECRB, but from a permitting perspective.
I absolutely agree, because in 1973 and 1989, the wall height was enough. You know, now in 2023, it's not. And it is going to be a big consideration.
Right. And it's part of our the instructions that we received was to look at this because it is part of BCDC's Bay Plan Amendment. And so it is a requirement, no different than, you know, many of the other bases of design. So I think we would be looking to Jen for at least some guidance as to how do we review future projects which do not address sea level rise because it is a repair project.
Yeah, and just to be to follow up on that discussion, I also think that this the sea level criterion is not driving the design. That going back to my first question, so it's not just that it's a repair; it's just that you know the loadings can be, let's say, extended to the top of the wall because of drainage and the like concerns. But you know, water ponding on the inside and then the tide dropping or something like that. But I think that's more of a civil engineering or, you know, kind of drainage issue that doesn't necessarily require that the, and in fact, the, yeah, so I kind of feel like it's not just a repair project, it's sealable. The high water level is not necessarily a design criterion for the project design. I don't know if I'm splitting hairs here, but that's kind of my rationale for not pushing harder on it as I usually do. And I will have to say I'm a little biased because it, you know, these are homeowners and it probably does make sense. I can go above my head here from a public policy standpoint to have a retaining wall that is upgraded and not doesn't fail with people there, you know, even if it is kind of inefficient in a long-term adaptation to climate change perspective. In other words, I think we'd all rather have the, see the seawall intact and functioning, even if it is a short term. So that's kind of my thought on how I'm not feeling too guilty about letting them off with sea level rise.
Okay. So I was looking back at the three questions that we were supposed to respond or answer today. And it sounds that like the design criteria of the site are appropriate with some more clarification and a bit more work and disclosure. Whether current flooding and future rising sea level impacts on the retaining wall are addressed adequately based on the references and the nature of the project, like we just had that discussion, and whether there are any design and physical concerns that have not been addressed. And I don't think we, I think we kind of have been pretty complete in our, you know, assessment of the project. So Jen, you've got all of that stuff written down now, right? Or, and I'm assuming that SGH and PJ and Bill have made copious notes as well, and that we'll see a letter. What does the, how does that work, Jen? Are you going, the letter will be sent to BCDC and will it go out to the members of BCRB just for review and comment?
I think what we need to do is make a motion and vote as a board that we agree with all of these points or not. And then we can send that and it becomes a motion from in the minutes of this meeting.
Yeah.
If you like, I'd like to, if you consider it in order, I'd like to make a motion and I can delineate, I think, in quick form, my summary of the points that we've got here.
Yes. Why don't you go ahead, Jim?
So I would like to make a motion that the board accept the project, but require the following additional input from the design team. First, related to liquefaction, to show the plots from CLIQ, that's spelled C-L-I-Q for whoever is taking minutes. And then explicitly evaluate the impact of those and, if appropriate, add a comment that the liquefaction won't affect the wall stability. Second, make a document, make documentation of design life of the project, including a discussion of the relationship to sea level rise. Third, require corrosion evaluation, including discussion of the demand and mitigation. Fourth, document UV resistance of the FRP and include specification requirements as appropriate. Fourth, document that it's a retaining wall, not a seawall. Fifth, require a clarification and documentation of Bill Rudolph's position and role in the project. And if I understood this correctly, then sixth, am I up to? Seventh, document how to accommodate water that may collect behind the retaining wall. That would be the end of the components of my motion. I would also down the road like to make a motion while I've got the floor here for a second, that we request, I think this is what how the discussion was going, is that the ECRB requests BCDC in the form of staff or maybe the DRB to address sea level rise criteria for cases like this, which are somewhat ambiguous. And we can talk about engineering criteria, but that's different than policy.
Well, I think that's a really good thing. Well, am I out of order?
We have a motion, and do we have a second? And then we can have discussion.
I'll second.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Now do we have any discussion on the motion?
Yeah, thank you. Sorry to be out of order there.
Okay.
I really like what Dilip and Jim brought up. In terms of special cases, but I wanted to ask, that's a question for BCDC, whether Jim wanted to address the lock-off loading on the tiebacks or not. I just had that on my list. That was the only.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I think that ought to be done, but I don't think that needs to be in our talk to the team.
Okay.
For the motion.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other discussion? Okay, so let's have a vote. Let's vote on this motion. Jen, do you want to call roll?
I think, did somebody second the motion?
Yes, Bob did.
Okay, great. I will call roll. Rod Iwashita?
Yes.
Jima Casale?
No, still on mute, Jima.
Just give a hand. Raise your hand.
Can we vote just by raising our digital hands, maybe?
Yeah.
Abdalia?
Yes.
Yes, and I will raise my hand and speak. Now I will lower my hand.
Justin Vannevar?
Yes.
Ramin Golsarki?
Yes.
Talia Travasaru?
Yes.
Dilip Trivedi?
Yes.
Jim French?
Yes.
Chris May?
Yes.
Is that everyone?
No, nope, Justin and Jima's back on, off of you.
Jima, so Casale?
Jen, sorry about that. Yes.
Okay, great. I think I got Justin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Everyone said yes.
Well, that's great. Then that motion passes. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Bob. Everybody. Let's see. Is there anything else here?
I was going to suggest a second motion that we request ECDC either the commission itself, DRB, or staff to address sea level criteria for odd cases like this.
So there is that workshop or that meeting that we're having next month on rising tides. Can I suggest we go through that first before we participate in that meeting before we make a motion and vote on something?
I'm okay with that. I would suggest that we make the motion just so that we've just go on record that this is a concern that we have. I don't think it may well be that the response is adequately performed by that upcoming meeting.
This idea, maybe this motion can be a discussion item in that future meeting for rising tides. Yeah. It might help trigger that discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of with Rod. I mean, I think the fact that we brought it up, I think the staff and I think Steve Goldbeck was on for a while. So, I mean, I think they've heard us. And, you know, one of the things that occurs to me, Jim, you had mentioned that the sea level rise is not really an engineering criterion or a criteria set. And I think that's true, but that's really only true because California and some other states are way ahead of the country. And, you know, ASCE, et cetera, has not come, you know, we don't have a code yet for sea level rise, but that doesn't mean that it's not important. And in our practice here locally, it's, you know, really considered. So it is a little unusual for us not to address that head on in a strong way. But I think, anyway, I do think it's a very important question. And one that I wrestled with before the meeting, you know, honestly. So I think it would be interesting to see what is being said. And I have some other comments about, you know, the program and how they talk, people talk about total water level and things like that. So I'd be okay with not making the motion or making the motion. I'll leave it up to someone else.
Rod, maybe can you explain why you think we should withhold making a motion now?
So I think BCDC staff are kind of going down this path already of how they want to look at or how they're looking at sea level rise. I'm a little nervous that if ECRB kind of tells, you know, BCDC staff to do something or to come up with something that they're going to come up that they may not, you know, be as free as they want to be to come up with their application or their interpretation of how or where things need to go. That's my concern, but you know, I'm hearing that it sounds like folks are wanting, you know, to be able to have some direction that we can just look at and do.
Well, you know, Rod, following that that comment you made, which I think is very astute. I mean, if I was on the staff, I might say, hey, wait a minute, why doesn't the ECRB tell us? I mean.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's there's a policy question, but there's also an engineering practice question that there may be a discussion that needs to happen before a decision can be made. In other words, we might have a role in that discussion. So
yeah.
I kind of like the idea of allowing it. There'd be a little bit of a process before we start defining what we want, kind of thing.
Right, and I think if we're looking at where is it appropriate to apply or require sea level rise, you know, be addressed in a project, talking with staff first and giving our considered opinions on it seems like the right venue. And I'd rather us not be here, kind of separated from staff, you know, asking for that clarification right now.
So I would speak in favor of the motion still. I think as actually, the motion's not been seconded yet, so we're not technically not discussing the motion. But I think that it's my understanding is the BCDC requires all applicants to address sea level rise. I guess there's some subtle language in there about what's a big project and what's a new project and six of an old existing project. But I think there's, to me, it's arguable that we aren't really meeting the request of BCDC by not requiring sea level rise in this particular case. And we're basically saying, yeah, we're taking the word of the applicant that we've got a short design life. And you know, it's really some kind of funny things that aren't engineering issues per se. If you want us to address sea level rise as an ECRB, then we can talk about the technical issues that's involved here. But we're basically saying we're going to accept the applicant's request that we not address sea level rise. So it's a funny position here. And I would like to just push it back to the ECRB, to the ECDC, the commission, or DRB, or somebody, and make sure that this is a specific question that gets addressed at our meeting to discuss sea level rise in general. I think this is one of the key issues of why they should have a meeting at all about the topic.
I absolutely agree. I'd be willing to second the motion on that. And my concern is setting precedent on, this is not a flood protection structure. It is a retaining wall. And therefore, I don't have to address sea level rise. And I think it is an important issue that we need to discuss. But I do think the ECRB and the DRB should be engaged in that discussion. So
that's my point. Like, let's have that discussion with DRB and staff, and then you know, we can address it. We may have a meeting the day after, or certainly within a couple of months, we will be able to make that motion and vote on it. But I suggest that we have that conversation first.
I agree with Rod. I mean, this issue is on the table. It's not like, you know, I understand the position in this discussion. I appreciate what Jim is saying, but, you know, to Rod's point, it's next month that this is going to be kind of discussed and I hope at some point decided on.
Yeah.
So that there's the direction, at least from this group, from BCDC to all the applicants, and then we can kind of make sure that it's included.
Yeah, I mean, Jen can take that. You know, I would say that that it's not just because it's a small project versus, there is no definition of a small versus large project, as far as I know in the guidance policy. But I think the biggest differentiator here is that there is no public access. So if you were looking at a project which has no public access, and it was not specifically for flood protection, and so therefore it is one of those special cases. And that's fine if that's how, you know, the directions to the ECRB are, you know, and staff might pick it up anywhere at a different, you know.
Yeah, and I think there are nuances like that, Dilip, that may not come out in a kind of, you know, one policy or in a policy vote.
Yeah.
And I think it's really worth us having this discussion and engaging with staff and DRB about, you know, where are the nooks and crannies where we're not going to enforce sea level rise requirements.
So Rod, I guess I'm still not clear why you're speaking against the motion. The motion that I said was a request that BCDC or staff or DRB address sea level rise criteria for cases like this. I think they're going to do that in a month, but this just puts us on record as saying, hey, the question matters to us because it affects how we do our job. So we're not asking them to do anything different than what's going to happen next month, except to say, hold ECRB's question in your mind as you're having this discussion.
So how about this? I mean, it seemed like, you know, we're all saying the same thing. I mean, can the motion be amended to basically say, you know, the ECRB thinks this is an important issue, which might require joint discussion between BCDC, DRB, and ECRB?
I'm willing to accept that as a friendly amendment.
I second that.
I like that.
Motion amendment.
Yeah.
So it's not a motion amendment necessarily. It's a friendly amendment that if I and Chris agree to it, then it just becomes a different
motion.
Am I
out of order again? Damn it. I'm going to go back on mute.
I'm fine with that.
Okay. And it sounds like we've already had our discussion. So, Jim, what is? Can you just state the motion one more time?
Have a Jima restate it because he had the revised language.
Yeah, I'd appreciate if Jima would repeat it.
So the ECRB moves that there be a discussion on the issue of sea level rise with respect to various projects, and that there be a discussion between the BCDC, ECRB, DRB to come up with a policy on how to address that issue.
Okay, thanks.
I'm okay if Jima becomes the mover of that motion.
Okay, I move. That's my motion.
Second?
I'll second.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Jim. Okay, everybody in favor, let's just raise our virtual hands.
I see.
Jim, you can just raise your regular hand if you want. Oh, there you go. Oh.
Well,
you might whack them all there.
Yeah.
My computer is not cooperating, but okay. My hand.
Okay. I see all 9 members of the ECRB have their hands raised in favor.
Okay, great. Is there any other business that we need to attend to? Okay, if there's not, is there a motion to close the meeting?
So moved.
Second. Yep. Everybody in favor, raise your virtual hand again. All right. Okay, thanks everybody. Great discussion. Look forward to seeing you next month. And This was fun.
Thanks, Rod and all.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Rod, Jim, everyone.
Good afternoon. Well, Jen, it's nice meeting you.
Thank you. Great to meet you all, too.
Yeah. Hi, Jen. Welcome. Thank you.